welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, May 8, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps Teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's Teleforum conference call and our analysis of the decision in the Williams-Yulee case handed down recently by the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. We're very happy to welcome back today two return guests to Teleforum. They are Professor Brian T. Fitzpatrick. He's a professor at the Vanderbilt University School of Law, and he'll be joined by Eric S. Jaffe. He's a sole practitioner with the Eric S. Jaffe PC Law Firm here in Washington, D.C. We're going to get opening remarks from each, and then we're going to turn to the audience for questions. I just want to give folks advance warning that we're having some difficulties getting Eric Jaffe on a landline telephone. I hope that's transparent to the audience, other than this announcement, of course, but we'll do the best we can to muddle through. With that, Professor Fitzpatrick, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dean. I'm happy to be here to talk about this case. This is the second case that the U.S. Supreme Court has decided in recent years about judicial free speech rights. And the first case the Supreme Court decided in this area was many years ago now. It was in 2002 when I was a law clerk to Justice Scalia, who wrote that 2002 opinion. It was Republican Party of Minnesota v. White. And in that case, the Supreme Court struck down another one of these ABA-inspired restrictions on the ability of judges and candidates who are running for election to speak. The court struck it down 5-4. It was along partisan lines. And the Republican Party of Minnesota v. White decision spawned over a decade now of litigation in the various states that have judicial elections against other ABA-inspired restrictions on the ability of these judges and these candidates when they're running for election to speak. And so we have come back to the Supreme Court now with a canon from the state of Florida. And so Florida elects its trial judges. Florida has a different system for its appellate judges. Florida depends upon something called the Missouri Plan or merit selection for its appellate judges, where a commission heavily influenced by the bar nominates judges to the governor, and the governor picks one of those people for the appellate courts. For the trial courts, they have good old-fashioned elections, and in Florida, there is still a ABA-inspired canon on the books, canon of judicial ethics, that prohibits judges who are running for those trial court elections, prohibits them from personally soliciting money for their election. So they have to run an election, but they cannot personally solicit money for their campaign. They're allowed to solicit money through a campaign committee, and they are allowed to know who gives them money, because they're allowed to write thank you notes to the people that gave them money, but they cannot solicit the money. And in this case, a lawyer that was running for the trial bench for one of the county courts in Florida wrote a letter, kind of an open letter, and sent it out to a bunch of people and put it on the internet. And the letter said, you know, why this lawyer was qualified to be a judge, and the letter said, you know, please give me a little bit of money to start my campaign. And the bar came down on this candidate for personally soliciting money in her campaign for the trial bench. And so the question then was litigated on whether this restriction on personally soliciting money violates the United States Constitution, in particular, whether it violates the First Amendment, whether people running for judicial office have a right to personally solicit money. The Florida Supreme Court said that the canon, you know, they promulgate the canons. They said the canon was constitutional, and the United States Supreme Court decided to review it. And I think in something of a surprise, the court ruled 5-4 that this canon was constitutional. It was okay to prohibit candidates for the trial bench from personally soliciting money. Chief Justice Roberts wrote the opinion, and he was joined by the four more liberal justices. And the principal dissent was written by Justice Scalia, but there was some shorter dissents written by Justice Kennedy and Justice Alito as well. So 5-4 with the chief flipping, if you will, to the more liberal side, and really flipping from the partisan divide on this issue that I think was created in the Republican Party in Minnesota v. White decision in 2002. And so just, you know, to go through the three questions the court had to answer in this case, number one was the question of what is the standard by which the court is going to review this particular restriction on judicial speech. Is it going to be strict scrutiny or something less than that? And honestly, I thought this was kind of a difficult question based on the precedent coming into this case. On the one hand, this is a content-based restriction. You know, if the person talks about money, then the person's prohibited from speaking. If they talk about other things, they're not. So it's a content-based restriction. Those normally get strict scrutiny. In Republican Party Minnesota v. White in 2002, the canon there prevented judges from announcing their views on issues that might come before them on the bench later on if they were to get onto the bench. And everyone in that case assumed strict scrutiny applied. And so there was certainly some reasons to think that strict scrutiny would apply here as well. On the other hand, you know, this is a content-based restriction on speech, but it's content-based about money. And there are some cases out there that when it comes to money speech, we have a more permissive regime. And, you know, there are some of these campaign finance decisions which don't apply strict scrutiny. And there are, of course, all the commercial speech cases where, you know, people are making commercial solicitations for money, and those do not get strict scrutiny either. So could have gone either way. But 8-1. 8-1, the Supreme Court rules that strict scrutiny is required. The only dissenting vote on that, I believe, was Justice Ginsburg. So we're in strict scrutiny land. But the Chief Justice said, in his opinion for the court, that this is the rare restriction that satisfies strict scrutiny. So the second question in the case was, what is the compelling interest here? And the Chief Justice said that the compelling interest to support this prohibition on solicitation of money was the integrity of the courts, or sometimes he phrased it as public confidence in the impartiality of the courts. And he was not very analytical or very precise about what exactly he meant by integrity or public confidence in the impartiality of the courts. And Justice Scalia really calls him out on this. He just really rests on some very vague kind of platitude-esque compelling interests here. And Scalia really goes after him there. In Republican Party Minnesota v. White, Justice Scalia really tried to do a very rigorous analysis of this impartiality compelling interest, and he divided it into all kinds of categories of what impartiality could mean. Here the Chief Justice said, it's hard to define this stuff, but of course it's important. Integrity, impartiality are hard to define, the Chief Justice says, but who could deny that they're compelling? So once the court gets past the compelling interest, and there's the question of whether the restriction here is narrowly tailored. And here the court, Chief Justice Roberts, does two things that Justice Scalia really, I think, gets a lot of traction in criticizing in his dissent. Number one, the Chief Justice requires absolutely no evidence that this particular restriction will sap public confidence in the courts, for example. There's really no empirical evidence given. There's really not even any anecdotal evidence that's given. It's really based on common sense. The Chief Justice thinks common sense suggests that these things will sap public confidence and impartiality and integrity. And that seems to be enough. Now, you know, that's often not enough in strict scrutiny land. Usually we do require a little more seriousness, a little more rigor in the evidentiary basis. I remember there was a case not too long ago about violent video games out of California, and there were actually some studies that showed that, you know, violence in video games led to various problems or conditions if young people got those video games. And I remember the court said in its opinion, you know, these studies that are cited to us, they're not very good studies because they haven't controlled for other relevant variables. They're not, you know, the regression analysis wasn't good enough. And so that wasn't good enough for compelling interest or narrow tailoring, at least, in the video game case. But here we didn't have anything like that, and it was good enough. So one question here is, have we watered down strict scrutiny a little bit with the Chief Justice's analysis? The other part of the narrow tailoring inquiry goes into whether the restriction here is over-inclusive or under-inclusive. And the Chief Justice was fairly dismissive of the arguments that there was under or over-inclusiveness here, not because he didn't think there wasn't over- or under-inclusiveness, but he basically said, you know, we don't require the states to tackle all the problems at the same time. And so he just really was not very serious, I didn't think, about inquiring into over- and under-inclusiveness. So, for example, this canon prohibits judges from soliciting any contributions from anyone, including the judges or the candidates' parents, even people that could never appear before the court because they live in other states or for whatever reason could never appear before this court. The canon still applies to those people. And Scalia says there's absolutely no reason to think that public confidence and impartiality or integrity would be threatened by asking people for money who can never be a party in a case before the judge. But the Chief Justice did not seem concerned about that. And so, you know, I think one aspect of this case presents some interesting and resolves some interesting First Amendment questions. Like I've said, strict scrutiny applying to the speech, how the strict scrutiny was applied. This is an interesting decision from a First Amendment perspective, and I think Eric will probably talk more about that when he has his chance to comment. But what I would like to say about the decision is not so much what it means as a First Amendment case, but what it means as a judicial selection case, because the undercurrent of this case was the same undercurrent we had in Republican Party Minnesota v. White, which is, how should we select judges? That's a question that is underneath the surface of this case, and it was before, and I'll tell you why. These canons that these states have, they come from the ABA again, and the ABA hates judicial elections. The ABA has been against judicial elections for a very long time. The ABA prefers what Florida does for its appellate courts, this Missouri plan or merit selection plan. Justice Scalia notes this in his dissent. He says, what a surprise, the ABA prefers this commission system because the commissions that nominate the judges to the governor are full of lawyers. They're lawyers' commissions. They're commissions often selected by the bar. And so the ABA prefers basically the bar picking the judges, and the ABA does not like judicial elections. And the ABA cannot stop the states from adopting elections because their elections are very popular. So what the ABA does instead is the ABA promulgates these speech restrictions that prohibit the elections from being very meaningful. They have really tried to do everything they can to take the wind out of the sails of the people that are running for judicial office to make the elections as meaningless as possible. And, you know, when the U.S. Supreme Court in Minnesota v. White said we're not going to let the ABA do that, the court basically had to make a decision. And the decision was, do we think judicial elections are an okay way to select judges? And I'll tell you, the dissent in that case was written by Justice Ginsburg. And the essence of her dissent was she thought the judicial elections violated the Due Process Clause. She thought that if you had a case in front of a judge that was elected, it violated due process. You were not getting a independent and impartial judge by definition. That was her view. And the Supreme Court, the majority, rejected that view and said judicial elections are just fine. And the reason why the court took that view in Republican Party Minnesota v. White was because there was a disagreement that was aired about how judges make their decisions. Are they made in the realist conception of the judge, or are they made in the kind of pre-realist conception of the judge? And what do I mean by that? Well, you know, for a very long time, and some people still believe, that judges apply the law in a very neutral way, that their own personal views do not influence their decisions. This, you know, used to be how we thought about judges until the movement in the early 1900s, the realist movement, made the case that, in fact, there's a lot of ambiguity in how judges do their work, and a lot of times that ambiguity is filled with the judge's personal views, for better or for worse. The judge's personal views about what is good and bad, what's good policy and bad, influences their decisions. That's especially the case if the judge is not going to be an originalist or a textualist. There's even more room for the judge's personal opinions to influence the judge's opinions. Well, if you believe in this realist view of the judge, that the judge's personal opinions will influence their decisions from the bench, then you can certainly understand why states would want to elect their judges. Judges are basically acting as lawmakers or policymakers to some extent. In a lot of states, of course, you have common law powers of the state judiciary as well. That's explicitly a lawmaking role, at least today as we understand what the common law is. And if you believe this about judges, then it makes perfect sense that you would want to elect judges. They're basically lawmakers or policymakers, so they should be accountable to the public. And that's the view that Justice Scalia put forth in his opinion in Republican Party Minnesota v. White. And Justice Ginsburg put forth the opposite view, that no, judges were different. And because judges were different, they were not supposed to be held accountable to anyone because they were making decisions based on the law, not on their policy preferences. So that view didn't carry the day in Republican Party Minnesota v. White, but one implication of today, or of this new decision, is whether the Ginsburg view now holds majority sway on the Supreme Court, that maybe Chief Justice Roberts wishes to endorse the Ginsburg view of it's the law and not the policy preferences of the judge that is doing the work in our judiciary. And if he does want to associate himself with that side of the question, then I think it does raise an issue about what kind of commitment the Supreme Court will have to facilitating judicial elections in future cases. There's a lot of canons the ABA has to try to diminish judicial elections, and it looked like for a while the lower courts were going to strike them all down because of Republican Party v. Minnesota. But now the Chief Justice has switched sides, so to speak. It's not clear to me what kind of commitment the U.S. Supreme Court has to facilitating judicial elections anymore. And so I think that is an important development out of this case. It does call into some question about how robust judicial elections will be able to be in the future. With that, Dean, I think I'll turn it over to Eric.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Can you guys hear me?
We can hear you just fine, Eric. Go right ahead.
Great. So thank you for bearing with me. I actually made it to my landline. I agree with so much of what was just said about this, and Fitzpatrick is right that I will make some comments on the how strict scrutiny was treated here. I'm not surprised that three of the four liberal justices went along with Chief Justice Roberts in saying strict scrutiny applies, because the game here is to kill strict scrutiny, not to refuse to apply it, but to water it down to a point where it's meaningless. And I think that's what we saw. that in order to get the ruling that strict scrutiny applied, Roberts was willing to make a mockery of it. And the other three liberal judges who joined him said, great, if that's what strict scrutiny means, we're on board. And lo and behold, look at Justice Breyer's concurrence that says, well, with the understanding that the two tiers are really meaningless and we can do whatever we want, I agree. So there's no surprise to me at all that they signed on for that. Justice Ginsburg is a little bit more of a stickler for the rules, and consequently it's equally no surprise that she declined to join that little game. And I think Scalia is spot on. If this is what you call strict scrutiny, you're just sort of spitting in the eye of strict scrutiny. This is not strict scrutiny. It's not close to strict scrutiny. It's a result-oriented answer. And for sort of, you know, it reminds me in so many ways of the rational basis scrutiny that gets applied in certain cases that looks awfully like intermediate scrutiny in some cases. And I'll let all the listeners figure out which those cases are. I'm sure they're well aware of them. And so that I found disappointing about this, that, look, if you want to say it's not going to be strict scrutiny because this speech is different, go ahead. I think that would be the wrong answer, but at least it would be candid. If you're going to say this is strict scrutiny because it's such wonderfully important speech, but it's okay to restrict it on a not terribly well-tailored rule that has no support for the actual injuries involved, well, you know, come on, that's not judging. That's results with a fake answer attached to it, which is pretty much what Scalia said, and I think he's right on the money on that. The second thing that struck me about this and about the comments that we just heard about what does this mean in terms of our view of the role and the procedure of judging, you know, is it the law or is it preferences? What always frusts me about these cases is that they arise inevitably out of the state courts, which are, of course, the only places you can have judicial elections, and no one bothers to wonder what it is about state court judges that somehow might be different and justify having elections in the first place. And the answer seems self-evident. The answer is that, of course, the answer is that they get to make policy. That's what they actually do. While federal court judges don't get to make the law, state court judges do. They routinely make the law in the context of common law, is the easiest instance of that, where their policy preferences, their judgments, their values indeed play a role in the making of the law, and not an illegitimate role like the critical legal studies folks would have you believe, but a perfectly valid role because that's how state judges are different. Well, given that, it's no surprise that we then want to elect them, because if they're going to be legislating, making judicial rules, then we want to have some say in the values and the views of those who legislate from the bench, legitimately legislate from the bench. While I agree with the Chief Justice and the majority that in other cases judges have to apply the facts and the existing law and any binding precedent in a neutral way, that is not all that they do. They are very much unlike federal judges in that sense. And so to apply the federal judge model of the neutral umpire who only applies the law and has no personal views at all about anything is false as to this category of judges. So the hostility that you see coming from the four more liberal justices and now potentially from Chief Justice Roberts toward judicial elections, I think just doesn't take into account or doesn't weight in any meaningful way the differences between federal and state judges. So that's something that I found disappointing, that there was no acknowledgement of why you might want to elect them and therefore why they indeed might be very much like politicians in some senses, even if not in every sense. Instead, the chief just sort of says, well, they're nothing at all like politicians. It's completely different. We don't have to treat them like politicians, and we expect more. The third thing that struck me, and I think also struck Professor Fitzpatrick, is that not merely the lack of evidence for these supposedly compelling interests, but really the definition of the sort of the core interest that he seemed to focus on. Scalia, I think, is correct that the interest he relies on switches back and forth at his convenience. But at the end of the day, if you're being fair about it, the interest that he's articulating is an interest in the appearance of judicial integrity, so public confidence in the integrity of the judiciary, which is very different than the actual integrity of the judiciary. It's okay if they lack actual integrity, as long as the public doesn't see it. And I think you see that fact most clearly in his attempt to distinguish thank you notes and committee solicitations from personal solicitations. So the judge can have his number two, his campaign chair, solicit on his behalf with his full knowledge of people that he's given a list for. The judge can then thank those, you know, find out what the result of that solicitation was and send thank you notes and keep a little checklist of who said no. And he can lack integrity in every conceivable way possible and actually take it out on those people. But since nobody knows, it's okay. That's the gist of what this says. Since no one knows, you don't have to worry about that, even though it poses an identical risk of judicial bias. It's just less visible. I actually think that that interest is invalid. It is not merely not enough. I think it is antithetical to the First Amendment. It's functionally an interest in misleading the public. We're not worried about whether there's genuine judicial bias. We're just worried about whether they see it. And so if we can keep it from their view, whatever's really going on behind the curtain is okay. That can't be a sensible way to structure campaign finance restrictions. And you see the same issue cropping up in normal campaign finance cases too, not just judicial cases, that the appearance of corruption is now the big interest that we rely on because we can never prove actual risk of corruption in most of these cases because of campaign contribution caps and things like that. So it's always the appearance that gets relied upon. And so I find that disappointing that that has become the primary compelling interest upon which all future restrictions will depend. One can imagine that if that is genuinely compelling, we should not publicize any kind of judicial discipline that shows a corrupt judge, that we should keep that private, completely private, because that would serve that interest perfectly. It's probably the least restrictive way to do it. And as long as you actually punish the judge and try to solve their actual corruption, as long as not letting anyone know about it is the best answer. And you know, anyone listening to that theory presumably is as repulsed by that notion as I am. So overall, I was disappointed that the chief switched over. I wasn't surprised that the four went the way they went. I think that was inevitable given Republican Party versus White. And, you know, it's a little odd that the chief bails out, given that he's usually pretty good on the normal campaign finance. And I think the answer has to be the one suggested that that Scalia suggested, at least, that this is about us, the Brotherhood of the Robe. And there's just a certain greater level of personal offense. And, you know, the assumption that we know what really goes on, it's almost like judicial fact-finding. Who needs stinking legislative fact-finding when we have our own smart brains clad in robes to tell us what's really going on? And it has that smell to it, which I think is effectively what Justice Scalia deridingly described. So with that, with those hostile and unflattering comments, I guess we can open it up for questions.
Terrific. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got three questions to lead us off. Before we go to those questions, let me make a quick announcement about our schedule of calls next week. We have a teleforum conference call each day next week on the schedule. Monday at noon, we'll have a discussion of patent reform, which has begun anew in Congress. Then that's Monday at noon. Tuesday at 1 p.m., these are all Eastern times. Josh Wright, commissioner on the FTC, will be talking to us about net neutrality. Wednesday at noon, we'll host a special CLE teleforum. That's a teleforum at which members can get up to 1 hour of CLE ethics credit. There's a payment requirement to actually earn the credit. You can join the call for free, but if you want to claim the CLE credit, there is a fee because we incur some fees in processing. But we're happy to do that Wednesday at noon. Thursday at 3 p.m., we'll be talking about GMOs and food labeling. And then Friday at 1 p.m., we'll be back on the First Amendment, this time looking at non-media speech and what sort of levels of protection it does and doesn't deserve. Today, of course, we're talking to Professor Brian Fitzpatrick and Eric Jaffe. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Before we take our first question, let me check back in with Professor Fitzpatrick and see if he wants to augment his statement based on anything Eric Jaffe mentioned.
No, Dean, I think that Eric and I have a lot of agreement about this decision. I will say one thing. He's absolutely right that the state court judges are ones for which the realist vision of judging holds most true, because they are explicitly delegated the authority state judges are to make common law. I would say, though, that even among federal judges, especially to the extent those judges do not follow originalist or textualist philosophies, their own personal worldviews are fair game for their decision-making methodologies. Whether or not something is constitutional or not often turns on the consequences of a ruling one way or the other, and those consequences are measured as good or bad by the worldviews of the justices and the judges that are sitting on those cases. And so I think the realist vision is accurate as a descriptive matter of both federal and state judges, but certainly more of state judges as well. And I will say, just in all fairness, I think if you are an originalist and a textualist, I think it's probably the case your worldview enters into your decision making, at least some, despite the fact that you don't want it to. History is often ambiguous, and which reading of history makes the most sense to you, I think subconsciously, probably depends a little bit upon your worldview as well. So I think the realist vision is a serious one, and I really think that all the justices of the Supreme Court buy into it. I just think that some are less willing to publicly say that's how judges operate, because they think that they like members of the public believing that judges are kind of above politics in some way, but I don't think it's very accurate.
Very good. Let's go to our first caller with a first question of the day here.
Hi, this is Will Trackman at Littler Mendelsohn out in Denver. I noticed that this is a judicial canon, not actually a law passed by the Florida legislature. Was there an angle to the case about jurisdiction? It seems like these people aren't judges necessarily that are running for these positions. I don't know, depending on Florida law, they might not even be admitted attorneys. What jurisdiction does the Florida Supreme Court have to issue and enforce regulations on people that may not be under their purview, if that was an issue in the case?
I was going to say, I don't recall this being much of an issue, and I understand that once you have put yourself up as a candidate for a judicial position, I think you've submitted yourself to the jurisdiction of the bar, which would cover judges. I don't know if you have to be a lawyer or not, but I think the bar would cover judges even if you didn't have to be a lawyer. They probably have the authority to discipline judges, actual judges, and hence, once you're seeking the position of a judge. Now, if you had done that and lost, I suppose that's an interesting question, whether or not they could then ultimately enforce it. But I have to assume that you basically consented to jurisdiction by placing yourself as a candidate. That's my guess, but I don't recall this being an issue one way or the other.
And so what happened just here as a factual matter, I'm getting this from the opinion. She was a lawyer who practiced law in Florida since 1991. And when she lost her election for the trial bench, and after she lost, the Florida bar filed a complaint against her, and the Florida Supreme Court appointed a referee who held a hearing and recommended that she be found guilty of violating this canon. The Florida Supreme Court adopted this recommendation from the referee and sanctioned her in an amount of $1,800, it looks like.
Yeah. So, I mean, at a minimum, she was a lawyer, so they certainly had authority over her in that sense. I can't imagine that it was an issue here.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just two questions pending, so we'll have time for others. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Bill Hodes calling. Eric remembers last time I called in.
Of
on
course,
one.
Hey, Bill.
We clerked together in the same year. I clerked for Justice Ginsburg, actually. And I'm going to be one of the panelists on the CLE next Wednesday, and one of the cases I'm going to discuss is the Yulee case. But I also was one of the reporters for the ABA Commission that recently, or 2007, revised the rules, and I think there's some interesting legislative history of what happened there. But before I want to just quickly say on that last question about jurisdiction, the way the jurisdiction was established is there is a crossover provision. The rules of lawyer discipline have a rule in them that says if you run for judicial office, then you as a lawyer must follow all of the judicial rules on as if you were already a judge. She lost, as was said, she lost in the primary, but since she was a lawyer, she was actually disciplined not as a judge, but as a lawyer for violating the lawyer rule that requires you to obey the judge rules. So with respect to what happened in the ABA, I want to just preface it by saying certainly you're right that the ABA is dead set against judicial elections, and I just want to disclose that I also wholly oppose judicial elections, but my view is, as in the White case, if you're going to have judicial elections, then they have to be real elections, and you can't hobble them in that way under the First Amendment. Secondly, I somewhat disagree with Eric and more agree with Brian about legal realism and state judges. And the main reason is that even under legal realism, and by which I mean anything other than crude legal realism, but real sophisticated legal realism, there are tremendous constraints upon the freedom of even state judges to make common law. Yes, they are lawgivers in that sense, but there's much more than that. Third point is when Brian surmised that perhaps just Chief Justice Roberts, who wasn't on the court at the time of the White case, was flipping sides and picking up Justice Ginsburg's view about that they're not politicians, elections are different. We know that for certain because very early in his opinion, when Chief Justice Roberts was setting up the dichotomy between judicial elections and political elections, the only thing he cited was Ginsburg's dissent in the White case, which is kind of unusual thing to cite. Finally, my point about and the ABA commission that was looking at all of the rules, not the lawyer rules, but the canons of judicial conduct were completely redone between 2005 and 2007. They were finally adopted. I was one of the two reporters on it. And the commission was several times importuned by various people, including me, one of its reporters, although I didn't have a vote, to change the language in the rule in question from candidates cannot personally solicit funds and flip it around to shall not solicit funds in person. And that was debated extensively. Many, many hours of debate were devoted to that. Ultimately, it was rejected because of the ABA's biases. But the obvious analogy in that is to lawyer advertising, including targeted mailings and so on, which are allowed but in-person solicitation of clients is not allowed. That to me, that would have been a perfectly reasonable, well-tailored restriction that, of course, you can raise funds, you just can't do it in person, hand-to-hand. That does look a little tacky, and it certainly would have been narrowly tailored, but that was rejected by the ABA, and now the Supreme Court has, you know, accepted that view. Just one last quote for your for the listeners in Alito's in Justice Alito's dissenting opinion. He had, I think, the best line of the opinion, although Scalia had the better analysis. He said, as to narrow tailoring, this regulation is about as narrowly tailored as a burlap bag. And so with that, I will send it back to the floor.
Comment from Mr. Jaffe or Professor Fitzpatrick?
Well, I'll say that, you know, interestingly enough, I don't think that my view on legal realism is that different than Professor Fitzpatrick's, and maybe not even than Professor Hodes, in that I think even in a federal court, a judge's views on all sorts of things are relevant, if for no other reason than they inform that judge's judicial philosophy. And when I say judicial philosophy, I don't mean simply, are you an originalist, are you a textualist? But there are flavors of those that I think are pertinent and relevant. And so I would certainly delve into those as someone, you know, if I were a senator, for example, just the way I would delve into them as a voter if I were voting for a state court judge. And I similarly think that while it is true that state court judges have this common law role, it's not clear to me that that's the majority of what they do. It's probably not the majority of what most judges do. And I thought this case was particularly odd, if I recall correctly. She was, you know, it'd be one thing if this was for the state Supreme Court that we're talking about, where the prospect of making law is a more realistic prospect. But when you're talking about the trial level and maybe even the intermediate level, intermediate appellate level, the prospect of making law is somewhat more limited. And so, yes, they smell a little bit closer to federal judges in that sense, in the you ought to be applying the law, yet at the same time you have to recognize that applying ambiguous laws often involves judgment, and judgment is informed by your values, by your background, by your overall philosophy toward judging, by many things. I don't think that makes me a critical legal studies advocate. I think that even the most strict of textualists and the most strict of originalists recognize that very often the text is ambiguous, and very often the history is ambiguous, and very often, even when it's perfectly clear, it asks for a judgment. For example, no unreasonable searches and seizures asks for a judgment, and so in that sense, I don't actually think there's a big gap between us in terms of what the role of sort of personal or philosophical views of candidates are toward judging.
Professor Fitzpatrick, do you have anything on this point?
No, I thought the listeners' comments were very, very helpful, and I appreciate them.
We've got just one question pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
Hi, this is Kurt Levy with the Committee for Justice. Greetings to Brian and Eric. And I'm going to broaden the subject a little bit by asking you, some conservatives over the last few years have worried that Roberts is drifting left, much as, you know, O'Connor, Stevens, and some other Republican appointees have done. Does this opinion here, you know, tell us anything about whether Roberts is slowly drifting left? If so, along what, you know, dimensions is he drifting left? Or is this really just about the fact that, you know, this is about the judicial fraternity? And then more specifically, does this change your prediction of how Roberts will vote on other cases that are still to be decided this term or that might be coming up next term?
Brian, you want to take that first or you want?
Yes, I mean, I think it's a very good question, and I guess I would say that there are a lot of examples now of where the Chief Justice has flipped sides in fairly politicized cases, and you could look at each one of them and say, oh, that was just about X, or oh, that was just about Y, but at some point you get enough of them strung together and you begin to wonder whether he is something of a swing justice. And I'm not sure we're quite at that point yet, but I do think it is at least a risk at this point from those, you know, who would see that as a negative thing. I think he may be in the process of making himself into something of a swing justice.
I guess my view on this is not that he is becoming liberal in perhaps the way that people viewed Souter, for example. I have always sort of viewed him a little differently as more of a statist. I think of these in terms of sort of libertarian terms rather than left and right terms. And he seems, in many instances, more willing to defer to the government. I think he comes from a background of government work. He comes from the SG's office, which defends the most horrific of government policies frequently. Even the most noble of SG's do it with while holding their nose. But so I'm not as surprised by this, and I don't think of it as that much of a difference. What really surprised me in a lot of instances is that he was sort of with the conservatives on the campaign finance stuff. And maybe that is because in those instances, he does see the gamesmanship, the party gamesmanship on those restrictions are designed to help one party hurt another party. And it just depends which party's in power as to who's trying to gore whose ox. But here in the judge context, I think it was very telling how he sort of gets rid of the under-inclusiveness objections by saying, look, the whole point of under-inclusiveness is because it raises a red flag that either you're trying to play games by including some people and not others, which just masks a viewpoint bias, or it just means that this is not very important, which therefore makes you wonder why you're doing it in the first place. And since there was very little of that concern here, what would have normally bugged him in a regular campaign finance case, that people are playing politics, perhaps doesn't bug him so much that this is not a viewpoint or a party-based rule. It is a we're judges and we're supposed to be above that kind of rule. So there's a certain distastefulness to the rule from sort of my perspective, but not from the same perspective that led him to join conservatives on the campaign finance cases. So at that point, his statism comes to the fore. He says it's government. They get to do what they want. They don't really need to give a whole lot of explanation because we all know what's going on. They don't need to be so super-duper tailored. They can sort of get close but not close enough. They can do it one step at a time. All these pablum excuses for government action that you wouldn't normally expect to hear coming out of the mouth of a conservative, yet you would expect to hear coming out of the mouth of a statist. And if you look back at some of Chief Justice Rehnquist's opinions, you will see the same kind of noise in First Amendment cases. And so I'm not surprised at all. I think it's more that.
Well, let's say he is genuinely evolving in terms of his view of strict scrutiny. What cases, upcoming cases, would you expect it to affect? And that's for both of you.
Go ahead. Oh, well, I'll let Brian go first. No, go ahead. I've spoken enough.
Well, you know, I don't have anything in particular in mind, but, you know, I do have a lot of concern over the Affordable Care Act case.
Yep.
That's the one that I'm most concerned about because there is a Chevron deference argument there in favor of the administration. And so if he were going to be, you know, in play in another one of these highly politicized cases, I think that would be it again.
I think it might be interesting to see how it plays out in the the gay marriage cases, same-sex marriage cases, in that his sort of statist tendencies would make you think he would just uphold the discretion of states to make their own rule. There does, you know, I mean, I think he could easily see that there's sort of bias there, that it's not simply a, oh, we just like tradition. He may sniff that out and go, and that may push him in the other direction. But for folks who thought he might have provided the swing, I think this provides at least some countervailing weight to that, given that he's willing to sort of go out of his way to justify state conduct. And maybe you'll see that trickle down and watch him apply something that looks a lot more like rational basis than, say, in Lawrence. It might have an impact there.
Thank you.
We've got two questions pending now in about 10 minutes. Let's see if we can get through these final questions.
Hi. I appreciate the comments so far, and I have felt like I've learned a lot. My question is just generally about this lower standard of scrutiny and just an attitude of deference. And I tend to agree that the Chief Justice himself has exhibited an attitude of deference and is in some ways, you would call it statist, and defers often to the political branch. I'm just wondering how you see this attitude of deference going forward in future election law cases, especially since I believe there's a recent opinion from, what was it, the circuit, where they did a review of some of the election laws, and they said there was no evidence, and they applied strict scrutiny quite long, and said there's no evidence as well as non-evidentiary policy reasons for upholding the particular statute. I was just wondering where you see election law going forward, especially since they tend to defer a little bit more in what would be strict scrutiny scenarios than they would for other perhaps free speech or First Amendment cases.
Well, like I said, if you're talking about non-judicial election law, I think there's a difference there in that most of these kinds of election laws, the political gamesmanship behind them is a little more obvious. So in the judicial elections, the gamesmanship going on is we don't like judicial elections as a category. It's not Democrat versus Republican gamesmanship. In most election laws, you often see straight-up political gamesmanship, but even more often you sort of see a pro-incumbent bias in these laws. And I think Roberts sees that, which explains why he tends to vote with conservatives in those cases, is because the pro-incumbent bias is really disturbing. And so I don't think this case necessarily acts as a harbinger for those cases, given that difference.
Yeah, I agree with that. There was an argument that there was a pro-incumbent bias involved with this canon at issue in Florida, because I guess the argument is it'd be harder to raise money if you were a challenger without being able to send out the personal solicitation. I think it's probably weaker than in a lot of these other situations that Eric has described, where it is more obvious who's the winner and who's the loser.
I believe we have time for a final question, so let's go to our final caller of the day.
Hi. Sort of a follow-up to that last question. Professor Ayers wrote an article in The Atlantic following up on the decision. Where they mentioned in Roberts' opinion, he said the opinion, if I understand it correctly, was limited to personal solicitation of contributions, but that logic could be extrapolated towards members of Congress. So theoretically, a congressional statute banning personal solicitation by members could withstand scrutiny, at least in the current composition of the court. Just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, I suppose if Congress wanted to pass a law that said we could not personally contribute contributions, I guess that law could be defended by saying something about the integrity and the impartiality of Congress. Now, whether anyone would see that as a compelling interest for Congress, I think, is a harder question, because, again, the Chief Justice said that judges are different and they're not supposed to be accountable to their constituents like politicians are or legislators are. And so he might say on that one that that compelling interest is invalid as applied to the Congress. And so I don't think that he would rule the same way, but, you know, I guess it's not entirely clear. What do you think, Eric?
I think that's right. I think the opinion made a great effort to distinguish regular politicians from judges, and I think you're right in citing the responsiveness comment that Roberts made. So I'd be a little surprised to watch him import that over to the regular campaign finance cases. I would not be at all surprised to watch the other four members of the majority here attempt to do that, but you know, they probably were attempting to do that anyway. I just don't see it. I don't see Roberts going there, because then sort of Scalia's criticisms are then proven true. The moment you walk this decision over into the regular political speech cases, Scalia's comment that you're just abandoning all of our First Amendment jurisprudence because you feel like it, suddenly is in point of fact happening. It would be an odd backhanded way to prove that your dissent calling you a liar was actually right. So I don't think he's going to do it.
Anything further on this, Professor Fitzpatrick, at this point?
Nope.
We've got about 2 minutes left. We're out of questions. Let me give each of you 60 seconds to express any final thoughts, and let's start with Eric Jaffe.
You know, the final thought is the one I have after I read a lot of cases like this, which is as much as I disagree with Justice Ginsburg on so much of this, I am so much happier for her candor in describing her position. She thinks this whole enterprise is designed to produce bias, and so she's going to squelch it. And in many ways, Justice Stevens were similar in that regard, even though I vehemently disagree with them. I really am disturbed by this. Well, underneath it all, I have my doubts about it, so I'm going to make stuff up to get me to an answer that I can live with. If you're really worried about public confidence in the judiciary, I'm not sure that blowing smoke up our collective rear ends is the way to instill that confidence.
Professor Fitzpatrick, a final thought.
Yeah, I guess my thought is, you know, the true import of this decision, I think, will play out in the lower courts over the next few years as we see what happens to, number one, the ABA's confidence in promulgating additional restrictions on judicial elections and strengthening the ones that are on the books now, and two, what lower courts do with the current restrictions that the ABA has promulgated and any new ones. I think, you know, whether this signals to the lower courts to go in the opposite direction they've been going on since Republican Party v. Minnesota, or Republican Party Minnesota v. White, that's something that we should keep our eye on.
Well, gentlemen, on behalf of the Federal Society, I thank you for your time today. We certainly appreciate this. Very informative and interesting teleform conference call. I thank you both. To our audience, thank you also for joining us. A reminder to check the Federal Society's website, because our schedule of upcoming calls changes from time to time. But our next scheduled teleform call is Monday at noon, when we'll be talking about patent reform. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.